All right, so welcome to another deep dive. Today we are going
deep into
Jonathan Edwards,
yeah.
The first great awakening in American Christianity. And
huge topic.
It is a huge topic.
Yeah.
And we've got excerpts from a lecture by Dr. Roger Green to sort of be our guide through all of this.
So yes.
For you, our listener, you know, you want big subjects. And you want to know them really thoroughly and quickly. I think.
And have those aha moments.
Have those aha moments, right?
Yes.
I think this deep dive is going to illuminate a really pivotal era and its lasting ripples.
I think you're right.
Okay.
And I think what's fascinating here is that what often gets simplified, I think, into a few famous names or like dramatic sermons.
Right.
It was actually really intricate and like a really widespread movement.
Right.
And understanding the First Great Awakening, it really does provide a central background for so much of what has shaped American
culture and thought ever since then.
Yeah. And at the heart of it is Jonathan Edwards.
Yes.
And now I think when many hear his name, they think of sinners in the hands of an angry God.
Right, fire and brimstone.
Right, the fire and brimstone.
Yeah.
But our source material reveals that he was actually a much broader and more nuanced figure.
Okay.
So to give you just a sense of this.
Okay.
Here's a powerful excerpt from Sinners. It's near the end of the sermon. And now you have an extraordinary opportunity, a day wherein Christ has thrown the door of mercy wide open and stands in calling and crying with a loud voice to poor sinners. How awful is it to be left behind on such a day to see so many others feasting while you are pining and perishing.
Wow.
Intense, right?
Yes, very intense.
It almost makes you think about, you know, as we're pursuing knowledge.
Yeah.
Are there like crucial understandings that we might overlook?
That's a really insightful parallel.
Yeah. You know, Edwards' urgent call to like seize this extraordinary opportunity for salvation.
Mm.
It definitely echoes the importance of grasping key insights in any field.
Right.
And I think what really stands out here
is
that stark division he creates between those who embrace the moment and those left behind.
Right.
It's a powerful image that clearly resonated then and still holds a certain psychological weight.
Yeah. And so our source material actually poses a question to us.
Okay.
It says, when we think of Jonathan Edwards, what are the main details that should pop out about his name or life and ministry that we love?
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that question.
That's good.
Yeah.
So let's unpack this a little bit.
Okay, let's do it.
What are the essential takeaways about Edwards that should really stick with us?
Well, the first crucial point is that he was American-born.
Okay.
As the source emphasizes.
Okay.
American-born theologian and philosopher.
Okay.
He wasn't some, like, you know, distant European thinker.
Right.
He was born and bred right here in America.
Right.
East Windsor, Connecticut.
Oh, wow.
And this grounding in the American experience gives his work, I think, a particular significance for understanding early American identity.
It makes him feel so much more like a homegrown intellect.
Yes.
Right? Grappling with these huge questions right here.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What else should we really understand about him?
Well, beyond his origins,
his
intellectual range was really remarkable.
Okay.
He wasn't just focused on theology.
Sure.
He was a significant philosopher.
Right.
A keen observer of the natural world, so a natural scientist.
Right.
And someone with a deep appreciation and understanding of language.
Wow.
He brought this incredible breadth of knowledge to inform his theological work.
So not just this single-minded, you know, religious figure.
Yeah.
He was engaging with the world on all these different
multiple intellectual fronts.
Yeah. And so here's what I think is really interesting.
Okay.
Our source stresses that he fearlessly brought all of that knowledge to the service of his faith.
Yes.
He could have been this, like, you know, celebrated philosopher in a secular sense.
Right.
But he consciously chose to really anchor everything in his religious convictions.
Precisely. And that element of fearlessness, I think, is so important.
Yeah.
He didn't try to compartmentalize his faith and his intellect.
Right.
He boldly integrated them in a way that was quite notable for his time.
Right.
And this fusion of faith and reason, while some might see tension there today, was absolutely central to who he was and what he did.
Yeah. And the lecture also highlights his role as a pastor.
Okay.
And how his deeply held beliefs led to a conflict with his congregation over this thing called the halfway covenant.
Okay.
Which he considered scandalous and not biblical.
Okay.
So this sounds like a really pivotal disagreement.
It was the halfway covenant was a practice in some congregational churches
yeah.
that allowed individuals who hadn't undergone a full conversion experience,
right.
but whose parents were church members, to have their children baptized.
Okay.
And Edwards saw this as weakening the spiritual integrity of the church
yeah.
and diminishing the necessity of a genuine personal faith.
Right.
And this kind of clash
yeah.
between a pastor's deeply held theological convictions
right.
and the prevailing practices or desires of a congregation
yeah.
is a dynamic I think we still see in religious right. communities today.
Right. It makes you think about how these fundamental issues of
yeah.
you know, tradition versus change and individual conviction versus communal acceptance.
Yeah.
How that plays out in all sorts of groups, not just religious ones.
For sure.
Okay, so the lecture briefly mentions the Edward Cantians,
mm-hmm.
his followers,
okay.
and their subsequent influence.
All right.
And it notes that while they became these important preachers, teachers, and writers,
yeah.
they also developed some viewpoints that differed from Edwards himself.
Okay.
Particularly concerning human free will and original sin.
Yeah.
So this sounds like a whole other
it is.
Complex development.
The Edwardsians represent the next wave of thinkers.
Right.
Engaging with his rich and often challenging theological legacy.
Right.
And their modifications and departures from his stricter Calvinism.
Right.
Offer a fascinating case study, I think, in how theological ideas evolve.
Totally.
And are reinterpreted over time.
Totally.
And as the lecture suggests, really diving into the specifics of their disagreements would be a substantial undertaking.
Yeah.
Perhaps a subject for a future deep dive.
Right, exactly.
If you'd be interested in exploring that further.
Noted.
But it also illustrates, I think,
yeah.
a common pattern in
yeah.
intellectual history where a founder's ideas become a foundation,
right.
but also a point of departure for later thinkers who refine, challenge, and adapt
totally.
Those initial concepts.
Okay, so, but shifting our focus now.
Okay.
The first Great Awakening wasn't just about Edwards.
Exactly.
Right? Our source introduces us to three other really crucial leaders who were active at the same time.
Well, Edwards is a key figure and intellectual powerhouse of the Awakening.
Yeah.
It was a much broader movement involving yeah. many individuals with their own distinct styles and areas of influence.
Right.
And looking at these other leaders gives us a much more complete and nuanced understanding of this really transformative period.
So first up is Theodore J. Frelinghuysen.
Okay.
And the lecturer mentions that he might be the least famous of this group today.
Right.
But he was very significant in this time.
Yeah.
That Dutch name certainly stands out.
It does. Theodore J. Frelinghuysen was a Dutch Reformed pastor
okay.
who ministered in New Jersey.
Okay.
His primary goal was to revitalize the spiritual life within the Dutch Reformed churches
okay.
in the middle colonies,
right.
areas like New Jersey, New York, and parts of Maryland.
Okay.
He was an itinerant preacher, meaning he traveled extensively to spread his message.
Right.
Much like the later circuit riders
okay.
in Methodist tradition.
So he was actively going out and engaging with different communities.
Yes.
Not just staying within the confines of a single church.
So that's right.
And interestingly, our source points out that he had a notable influence on Presbyterians.
Yes.
Presbyterian ministers heard him preach
uh-huh.
and were inspired by his emphasis on revival, taking those ideas back to their own congregations.
Right.
So that shows a real impact across denominational lines.
Absolutely. It highlights how the spirit of religious awakening
right.
transcended strict denominational boundaries.
Right.
Frelinghuysen's focus on personal piety
right.
and a more dynamic and emotionally engaging style of worship
right.
resonated with people from various backgrounds,
yeah.
contributing to the overall momentum of the awakening.
Okay, so next we have Gilbert Tennent,
okay.
who was Presbyterian and directly influenced by Frelinghuysen.
Uh-huh.
And there's this really compelling story here about his father,
oh yeah,
William Tennent.
Okay.
Who felt that the training for Presbyterian ministers in the colonies wasn't adequate?
Yes. William Tennent was deeply concerned about the level of education and spiritual formation of ministers. In the Presbyterian church in America,
okay.
he felt it wasn't rigorous enough.
Right.
So he took the initiative to personally train his three sons,
right.
including Gilbert,
yeah.
for the ministry right in their own home.
And this is where the famous Log College comes into the picture, right?
That's right.
This very humble
yes.
log cabin where he educated his sons.
Yes.
It's almost a bit ironic
yes.
that this simple training center, derisively called a log college,
uh-huh.
ultimately became Princeton University.
Yes.
In 1746.
That's right.
Talk about a significant aha moment.
It is a truly remarkable example of how dedicated grassroots efforts can have unforeseen and far-reaching consequences.
Yeah.
The Presbyterians in establishing Princeton
were
addressing a very real need for well-educated clergy.
Right.
And William Tennant's Log College, despite its humble origins, became the seed for that lasting legacy in American higher education.
Yeah, and Gilbert Tennant himself followed in his father's footsteps.
He did.
Becoming a leading figure in the revival movement among Presbyterian churches in New Jersey and beyond.
That's right.
Caring for that passion for spiritual awakening.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that Princeton Theological Seminary still has a Tennant campus today really underscores the family's enduring impact.
Yes, their impact is still felt today.
It really brings that history to life.
Yeah.
It shows how these seemingly small events can have massive repercussions.
Absolutely.
Now, the third key leader here is George Whitefield.
All right.
Who's described as a pretty remarkable person.
He was.
And absolutely vital to the First Great Awakening.
Yeah.
His dates are 1714, 1770.
Okay.
And he was Anglican, which distinguishes him from the other leaders we've discussed so far.
Yes. Whitefield's Anglican background provided a different avenue, I think, for the spread of the awakening, connecting it to the Church of England and its influence in the colonies.
Okay.
He earned the well-deserved title, the Grand Itinerant.
Because of his extensive travels,
he
made an astounding 7 voyages across the Atlantic to America.
Wow, 7 voyages.
Which was an incredibly arduous and dangerous undertaking
in
those days.
Yeah.
And this constant travel allowed him to reach a vast and diverse audience throughout the colonies.
Yeah.
More so than perhaps any other single figure.
That really emphasizes his dedication.
Yes.
And the sheer effort involved in spreading his message.
Right.
And then there's this really fascinating detail about his burial in Newburyport, Massachusetts.
Oh, yes.
Right underneath the pulpit of a church that he helped to establish.
Yes.
And the story about admirers attempting to take his bones as relics.
It speaks to the almost celebrity-like status.
Wow.
That some of these powerful preachers attain during the awakening.
Yeah.
Whitefield's exceptional oratorical skills.
Yeah.
And the intense fervor he ignited in his listeners led to these extraordinary reactions even after his death.
Wow. And so, and if you ever find yourself in Newburyport, visiting that church and seeing his burial place is a very tangible way to connect with this pivotal period of history.
Yeah, the lecture highlights a significant contrast in Whitefield's approach to revival compared to Edwards, Frelinghuys, and Tennant.
Right.
While their revivals tended to be more contained within existing church structures, Whitefield famously preached outdoors in the open air.
This was a really radical departure from the established norms of preaching within church buildings.
Right.
Whitefield was convinced that the gospel needed to reach everyone, not just those who regularly attended church.
Right.
And this commitment to open-air preaching was a key factor in the massive crowds he was able to attract.
Right.
It literally brought the message to where the people were.
And the sheer scale of his impact is almost unbelievable.
It's pretty remarkable.
We're talking about estimates of him preaching to around 8,000 people a day for an entire month in 1740, including gatherings on Boston Common.
Wow.
And the fact that Benjamin Franklin, a figure known for his pragmatism and rationalism, witnessed this in Philadelphia and was struck by the power of Whitefield's voice, even in open natural settings, is quite remarkable.
It truly underscores Whitefield's exceptional abilities as an orator.
Right.
He could command the attention of vast audiences without any modern amplification, relying solely on the power of his voice and the compelling nature of his message.
Right. And his innovation of the field pulpit.
Yeah.
This portable structure he could set up anywhere.
That's right.
Further facilitated this widespread open-air ministry.
He was utterly committed to reaching the largest possible audience.
Right. And so his preaching style was also distinct, wasn't it?
It was.
It focused more on appealing to the heart and emotions.
Yeah.
The individual's personal experience of faith, as opposed to Edwards' more intellectual and almost legalistic style of argumentation.
Exactly. Whitefield's preaching was much more direct,
right.
more emotionally resonant.
Right.
His aim was to stir people's hearts
right. yep.
and inspire a deeply personal encounter with God.
Yeah.
And this emphasis on individual experience had a profound impact on many
yeah.
who felt disconnected from the more formal or intellectual religious practices of the time.
Yeah.
Interestingly, Whitefield's example directly inspired John Wesley to also embrace open-air preaching in England,
oh, wow.
demonstrating his influence even beyond the American colonies.
Wow. And so the lecture outlines four key aspects of Whitefield's setting for the gospel.
Okay.
Preaching in the open air, using language that everyone could understand,
okay.
appealing to the heart and emotions, and serving as a model for later evangelistic preaching.
Yeah.
It's pretty clear how these elements contributed to his widespread appeal and the overall impact of the awakening.
These four elements really represent a fundamental shift okay. in how the Christian message was communicated and received
yes.
by breaking away from the physical limitations of church buildings,
right.
using everyday language,
yeah.
connecting with people on an emotional level,
all right.
and setting a powerful example for future preachers.
Yeah.
Whitefield significantly reshaped the landscape of religious expression in America.
And the lecturer makes a really insightful point.
Okay.
Connecting these methods used by the religious leaders
right.
to a broader cultural and even political impact.
Huh.
The idea that these techniques for reaching and moving large numbers of people in this way
right.
had an influence on how political discourse developed in American culture.
It strongly suggests that the First Great Awakening not only transformed the religious landscape of the colonies,
right.
but also contributed to a growing sense of public engagement
right.
and the development of skills in mass communication.
Right.
That would have significant implications for the emerging political consciousness
yeah,
and fine. Eventual movement towards independence. The ability to address and persuade large audiences became a valuable tool in both religious and later political arenas.
Okay, so the First Great Awakening was clearly this powerful and widespread movement.
Yes, it was.
But it wasn't universally embraced, was it?
No, a movement of this scale and intensity is bound to generate a range of responses.
Right.
The First Great Awakening certainly had its enthusiastic supporters.
Yeah.
And also its very vocal critics.
And our source details three key types of reactions.
Okay.
First, there were divisions within denominations, mm-hmm. specifically among the Presbyterians.
Right.
Leading to the formation of the New Side Party and the Old Side Party.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't a formal split into separate denominations at that point.
Right.
But it sounds like some serious internal conflict arose.
It was the New Side Party largely embraced the revivalist spirit.
Okay.
The emphasis on personal religious experience.
Right.
And they were even open to relaxing some traditional rules and allowing lay individuals to preach if it helped to spread the awakening. The Old Side Party, on the other hand,
yeah.
was more traditional conservative and deeply concerned with maintaining order and control within the church.
Okay.
Especially regarding who was authorized to preach.
Okay.
They viewed the emotional displays
yes.
and what they perceived as excesses of the awakening with suspicion, even questioning its Christian authenticity.
Okay.
And these tensions created significant divisions within Presbyterian congregations and leadership.
Then there was the strong opposition from prominent individuals like Charles Chauncey.
Oh, yeah.
The sophisticated pastor of Boston's First Church Congregational.
Uh-huh.
He apparently viewed the entire awakening as a total botch.
He did.
And a disgrace to the church.
Yes, Chauncey represented a more rationalist
right.
and intellectually oriented approach to faith.
Okay.
He was deeply skeptical of the emotional intensity and what he saw as the anti-intellectual aspects of the awakening.
Okay.
And ministering to a prominent and influential congregation in Boston,
right.
he actively preached against the movement.
Right.
And his theological disagreements eventually led him towards Unitarianism.
Right.
Further illustrating his fundamental differences with the evangelical thrust of the awakening.
Right.
And the image of Chauncey preaching against the awakening in his esteemed church.
Yeah.
While Whitefield was drawing massive enthusiastic crowds nearby on Boston Common.
Wow.
Really highlights the starkly contrasting perspectives that existed at the time.
Yeah. And then finally, there was opposition.
Okay.
From within established universities like Harvard and Yale.
Yeah.
Which seems kind of surprising given their historical connections to Puritanism
right.
and Congregationalism.
It is somewhat ironic considering their founding missions.
Right.
However, by this period, Harvard was already beginning its shift towards Unitarianism,
right.
which helps explain some of its skepticism towards the more traditional evangelical theology
right.
that fueled the awakening.
Okay.
Yale's story has an interesting twist.
Yep.
Despite its initial opposition, it later became a key center for the Second Great Awakening in America around 1800.
Wow.
Demonstrating a significant shift in its theological orientation over time.
Wow.
And the university's opposition stemmed in part
yeah.
from the public and often emotional nature of the revivals.
Okay.
As well as the increased involvement of ordinary lay people.
Right.
Which challenged the traditional authority of the educated clergy and the established modes of intellectual discourse.
Right.
You can almost picture someone like the learned Charles Chauncey.
Yeah.
Witnessing the perceived chaos and emotionalism of an open-air revival.
Right.
And finding it deeply unsettling.
Right.
And the lecturer's brief mention of excesses in other revivals.
Yeah.
Like some of John Wesley's followers reportedly barking like dogs.
Right.
Gives us a glimpse into the kinds of behaviors that critics found so objectionable
yeah.
and used to dismiss the entire movement.
Okay, so despite this opposition,
oh.
the First Great Awakening clearly had a very significant and lasting impact.
Absolutely.
And the lecturer categorizes these results into theological and social contributions.
So let's start by looking at the theological changes that occurred.
All right. So theologically, one of the most significant outcomes
okay.
was a clear resurgence of Calvinism.
Okay.
The four key leaders we've discussed, Edwards, Frelinghuysen, Tennent, and Whitefield.
Yeah.
All operated within a Calvinist theological framework,
right.
which emphasizes God's absolute sovereignty
right.
and the doctrine of predestination.
Wow.
And their prominence led to a renewed emphasis on these Calvinistic doctrines in American churches and in public discourse.
Right.
And just to briefly explain, Calvinism is a major branch of Protestantism
yeah.
that stresses God's ultimate authority.
Right.
And the idea that God has already determined who will be saved.
Right, so that makes sense with such influential figures.
Yeah.
All grounded in that particular
That's right.
theological understanding.
Yeah.
So what other theological contributions came out of the First Great Awakening?
Well, another really important development was the revival of what's called experiential piety. And this marked a shift in how people understood their faith.
Yeah.
It moved beyond simply an intellectual assent.
Right.
to religious doctrines,
yeah.
to emphasize the importance of personal experience,
yeah.
the inner life,
yeah.
and a heartfelt connection with God.
Right.
And preaching began to be directed at the whole person, mind, will, and emotions, not just the intellect.
So it wasn't enough to just understand the theological concepts.
Right.
There needed to be a personal and emotional
yes.
engagement with faith.
Precisely.
Okay, and then this emphasis on personal experience
yeah.
led to individual conversion.
Yes.
Becoming the central test for authentic religious life.
That's right.
It wasn't just about knowing church doctrines or participating in rituals.
Mm-hmm.
It was about having this discernible personal encounter
right.
with Christ
mm-hmm.
and being able to articulate that experience.
Yeah.
This focus on individual conversion became a defining characteristic
yes.
of American evangelicalism.
That's right.
And finally, on the theological front, the First Great Awakening spurred
yeah.
this renewed concern for higher education,
okay.
leading to the establishment of several colleges with explicit religious affiliations,
right,
including Princeton Brown Queens College, which is now Rutgers, and Dartmouth.
Yes. These institutions were founded primarily to educate and train ministers
okay.
and to foster theological scholarship within their respective denominations.
Right.
Presbyterian Baptist, Dutch Reformed, and Congregational.
Right.
And they played a crucial role in shaping the intellectual and religious leadership of the colonies
yeah.
and the emerging nation
right.
for generations to come.
Okay, so now turning our attention to the social contributions
okay.
of the First Great Awakening.
Right.
The first one our source mentions is the elevation of the common person.
Right.
And this sounds like it was a really profound shift.
It was truly transformative.
Yeah.
The emphasis on personal conversion meant that an individual's direct relationship with God,
yeah.
their own religious experience, became as significant as that of the wealthy or those in positions of power.
Right.
Everyone was seen as equal in the eyes of God.
Yeah.
Regardless of their social standing.
Right.
And this challenged the more rigid social hierarchies that had previously dominated colonial society.
And this elevation also created new opportunities
yeah.
for ordinary lay people to speak and even to preach within their churches.
Absolutely.
which would have been a pretty significant challenge to traditional church authority.
It empowered individuals who were not ordained clergy,
right,
to take on leadership roles and share their faith experiences within their congregations.
Right.
And this reflected a broader democratization of religious life.
Right.
Building upon the existing congregationalist traditions in some denominations.
The lecture also highlights the development of personal independence in religious life.
Okay.
The idea that religious faith was a matter of individual free choice.
Right.
A personal decision to say yes or no to God.
Mm-hmm.
And this concept seems to have had implications beyond just the religious sphere.
It did indeed.
This growing emphasis on individual agency and the freedom to choose one's religious beliefs,
right,
arguably mirrored and even helped to fuel,
right,
the burgeoning ideas of independence in the political realm.
Right.
If individuals had the right to determine their relationship with God,
yeah,
based on their own conscience,
yeah,
the argument began to take shape that they should also have the freedom to determine their relationship with earthly authorities and governments.
Right.
The concept of being able to say no to religious authority,
yeah,
likely contributed to a growing sense of the possibility,
yeah,
of saying no to political authority as well.
Right.
The awakening fostered a sense of individual agency and the questioning of established authority in the spiritual realm,
right,
which arguably laid fertile ground for similar challenges to political authority.
Right. And finally, the First Great Awakening contributed to the eventual idea,
yeah,
of the separation of church and state in America.
Right.
And it's interesting to hear the lecturer's perspective on the original intentions,
uh-huh,
behind this principle.
The primary impetus behind the push for separation of church and state,
yeah,
during this period was the desire to prevent the government from controlling or interfering with the church.
Right.
Drawing on historical examples of religious persecution,
yeah,
and the concerns of minority religious groups like the Baptists, as well as the earlier advocacy of figures like Roger Williams.
Oh, right.
And the initial aim was largely to protect the church from state intrusion.
Right.
Not necessarily to completely exclude religious values or influence from public life,
right,
which is a more nuanced and often debated aspect of the concept today.
So to bring it all together, this deep dive into Jonathan Edwards,
yeah,
and the First Great Awakening, guided by Dr. Green's lecture,
yes,
has shown us this period defined by powerful individuals,
yeah,
diverse theological approaches,
uh-huh,
significant social change,
right,
and enduring legacies.
Absolutely.
We've seen how figures like Edwards Frelinghuysen Tennant and the electrifying Whitefield, mm, sparked a widespread religious fervor,
uh-huh,
that generated both passionate support and considerable opposition.
That's right.
And we've explored the profound theological and social transformations that resulted,
yeah,
from a renewed emphasis on Calvinism and the centrality of personal conversion,
uh-huh,
to the elevation of the common person,
yeah,
and the early stirrings of ideas about religious and political independence.
What's really striking, I think, are the unexpected connections we've uncovered.
Yeah.
Those real aha moments,
yeah,
from the humble origins of the Log College,
right,
blossoming.